All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of California, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court, sitting in bank, is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, to the second day of our special session here in Santa Barbara. The clerk will call this morning's calendar.
For the Supreme Court of California, holding oral arguments in special session in Santa Barbara, California, on Wednesday, October 4th, 2006, at 9 a.m., is as follows. Case number S123832, Aguacaliente Band of Cayula Indians, Petitioner v. Superior Court, County of Sacramento, Respondent, Fair Political Practices Commission, Real Party in Interest. For the petitioner, Mr. Martin. For the real party in interest, Ms. Kenyon. Case number S129220, R. Thomas Fair, plaintiff, cross defendant, and appellant, v. Carl E. Bhaktihara, et al., defendants and respondents, Stones Fair Financial Corporation, et al., defendants, cross complainants, and respondents. For the respondents, Mr. Chartis. And for the appellant, Mr. Serrato. Case number S034725, In re Andre Burton on habeas corpus. For the petitioner, Ms. Romero. And for the respondent, Mr. Marr.
We'll proceed initially in the matter of Aguacaliente Band versus Superior Court, hearing first from Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. James Martin for the petitioner, Aguacaliente. As the court's well aware, until the decision below, the controlling law on the narrow question of the tribe's sovereign lawsuit immunity was uniform and it was unambiguous. No case had abridged a federally recognized Indian tribe's right to sovereign lawsuit immunity.
Has there been any case, though, that has involved a state interest as substantial as what is arguably involved here, namely the right of a state to regulate its own political process, as opposed to, of course, other contexts where purely private contractual interests may have been involved?
Well, Your Honor, the answer to that question is there is no case specifically that has implicated state election laws in the suit immunity analysis. But there have been many other cases brought where the immunity was considered, where the rights were personally significant or significant as a matter of state law.
But did they go to the core of a governmental function as opposed to more private or personal interests?
Very much to the core of interests that included taxation in the Oklahoma Tax Commission case, a core governmental function, and one that certainly is reserved to the states and an extraordinary power. Access to the courts was at issue in the Wold case, certainly a fundamental proposition. There's been wildlife conservation, personal rights in the Santa Clara Pueblo case, a whole panoply of interests tantamount to our own constitutional rights. And again,
isn't protecting the political process more important than all of those considerations?
It may be, Your Honor, but that kind of weighing actually has no place in the suit immunity analysis.
How does California then effectively guard against political corruption if it cannot enforce the Political Reform Act?
Let me start with the notion that there are ways to regulate political corruption, Your Honor, independently of allowing a suit against an independent sovereign. And let me also say that given the controlling U.S. Supreme Court authority interpreting our Constitution, that is the result that the court has to reach here.
And what controlling authority are you referring to?
The controlling authority comes to us from 200 years of U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence that establishes three essential propositions that are critical to the resolution of this case. Let me start with the first one. For 200 years, the Supreme Court has never wavered from the view that the tribes enjoy sovereign status as a result of our constitutional design. The second thing that they have said unwaveringly for 200 years.
When you say they, you may have clarified it, but I may have missed it. Who do you mean by they?
The justices of the U.S. Supreme Court in every opinion that they have issued.
And what cases specifically are you referring to? Included among the line of authority that I'm sure you have in front of you. Would there be such cases? Is that the Clara Pueblo versus Martinez? Where the High Court said, without congressional authorization, the Indian nations are exempt from suit. And then looking at Potawatomi tribe, there the United States Supreme Court said, suits against Indian tribes are thus barred by sovereign immunity, absent a clear waiver by the tribe or congressional application. I presume that you consider this naturally, from your perspective, as supporting your view that your client, the Indian tribe, cannot be sued because of sovereign immunity.
I do, Your Honor, and I wanted to start with that sovereign status first, as the first proposition. And you can go back to the Oneida tribe case, the Montana Blackfeet case. And so the first starting, working, unwavering principle here is sovereign status for the tribes.
But then, if we were to agree with you that, yes, if this court were to look and follow the dictates of the High Court pertaining to the sovereign immunity status of Indian tribes, then I think to follow up on a question posed by Justice Chin, would this mean that an Indian tribe, given its sovereign immunity status, can with impunity violate the laws of California, such as occurred in this particular case, last-minute contributions of $1 million to political campaigns, etc., etc.? What would be the remedy if we were to agree with you?
Well, there's three pieces to that question, and I want to start with the first one and move to the last one. The first piece is, again, that the reason that a lawsuit is unavailable to the state here starts with the tribe's sovereign status. The other proposition that is clear from the United States Constitution and the Supreme Court's authority and the second leg of the analysis is that control over the tribe's sovereign status rests with Congress. And the third piece is that that sovereign status confers lawsuit immunity.
But
now,
Mr. Martin, getting back to my question,
right.
What is the remedy? I mean, we've been talking about sovereign immunity, but
yes.
Is there nothing that a state can do?
No, Your Honor, there are things that the state can do, but let me just stick with sovereign status and sovereign immunity for a minute, and let's look at how that works, whether it's the state that's in a lawsuit, whether it's the federal government that's in a lawsuit, or whether it's a tribe that's in a lawsuit.
Well, getting to the core of the problem, because you may be running out of time, this is a very difficult case where we're dealing with sovereign immunity, and if we agree with you, does this mean that a tribe can with impunity violate California's laws? Or is there some other remedy? What does this does this particular law require? Would it be possible that if, as you argue, the state cannot go against the Indian tribe, would the recipient of the $1 million campaign contribution have to declare that? And does that mean that as a result the public knows that, oh yes, the Indian tribe has contributed $1 million to this particular campaign? So even though the Indian tribe may be violating California's law, presumably, and this is what I'm trying to find out from you, presumably the recipient of the $1 million or whatever is at stake would have, under the law, to report that campaign contribution?
The answer is to that is yes, and it would be regulated. And that is an alternate way for the state to obtain information regarding contributions.
But
and
isn't it a fact that you have the recipient and the donor making a report to the government entity that they are making a contribution? Isn't that an important check and balance to make sure that everybody is playing by the rules?
It is an important check and balance in the construct of
and
the PRA.
And you would urge us to find that the tribes should not be forced to make that disclosure.
I would urge the court to find something very narrower and much narrower than that, and that is that the FPPC cannot use a lawsuit against the tribe to enforce that particular regulation. And the reason
how would you have us let the commission enforce the rules?
The U.S. Supreme Court has given us the answer to that in construing the immunity in cases like Oklahoma Tax Commission and Kiowa Tribe. Where you start is with congressional action. And congressional action has been a viable response to cases involving lawsuit immunity from the time that it was embedded in our Constitution.
So states have to rely upon the goodwill of Congress to protect their vital interests?
Excuse me, Your Honor, I'm sorry,
no.
I interrupted. The answer is in the context of authorization to file a lawsuit, Congress is one option that the states can pursue, and it is one that the law has said is a viable option. And if the problem is pervasive, Congress has responded.
Let me ask you this in view of your reliance on Kiowa. I don't read that case as supporting your position as strongly as you urge. It seemed to me that that case criticizes the doctrine of tribal immunity, of sovereign immunity, and that basically, and is somewhat unfair and outdated, and it seems to be that the U.S. Supreme Court in that case is deferring to Congress, but willingly deferring to Congress, and isn't indicating that it is deprived or that states are necessarily deprived of all authority where the interest is as substantial as it is here. Now, that's my read on the case. I don't think that Kiowa is as firmly supportive of the doctrine as you suggest it is.
Let me say that in the Kiowa Tribe case, the court ultimately described the rule of sovereign suit immunity as the overarching rule, settled law, coming from its own opinions, and did indicate that Congress was the body that had to overrule it.
But wasn't that willingly a deference to Congress rather than it having to be Congress? And didn't it criticize the doctrine as outdated and sometimes unfair in its application?
Yes, but the doctrine itself flows from the Constitution. It's embedded in the Constitution and provided there, so the court understood that it wasn't at liberty to take the next step and do away with it.
Now, as long as we're talking about outdated doctrines, wasn't the basis for sovereign immunity to protect the Indian tribes? And hasn't that premise been removed by the success of Indian gaming and the ability of the Indian tribe, in this case, to donate over $1 million to a political campaign?
The premise hasn't been removed at all, because the notion of sovereign immunity means that people deal with each other on a government-to-government basis, and sovereign immunity protects the tribes' autonomy and decision-making. That is still just as viable today as it was 200 years ago, which also leads to the next point on how the state might respond here concerning the regulation of these issues. They can make a compact and tribal agreement with the tribe. The second thing that the U.S. Supreme Court suggested was a viable option. The tribe was at the bargaining table here. The FPPC left the bargaining table. So that option is available, just as Justice Davis pointed out in his dissent below.
What there, exactly was that option? You mean that from your perspective, you would have the state and the Indian tribe get together and see whether the Indian tribe would agree to being sued?
It was on the table, Your Honor, and part of the discussions that the tribe would waive the immunity and submit to the PRA. That's how you should do it, government to government.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Martin. Isn't the general rule that foreign governments do not get to participate in the electoral process?
As far as I know, yes.
All right. And in this case, the Indian tribe is being asked to be recognized as a sovereign government, separate from the government of the United States and the state of California.
Yes.
Aren't they asking to have their cake and eat it too, then?
Well, not necessarily, because, again, we have to look at the narrowness of the issue here, which is the ability to bring a lawsuit against the tribe to enforce the state. And the U.S. Supreme Court has made it clear that tribal participation in the activities of society is not a means for waiving that immunity. And so, just as the state...
So they do get to have it both ways, because, according to your analysis, if I understand it, they are a particular sovereign recognized by the Congress, and the result of that rule in this case is they do get to participate, unlike any other foreign government, and they don't have to be accountable in a court of law for violations of the FPPC.
Well, the answer to that, as a result of the court of law, yes, by virtue of our constitutional design. But then, if I can get back to this remedies point, the state has the ability to sue the recipients. It has the ability to sue or regulate the lobbyists. It has the information available that it wants in this case, which, by the way, is not contributions. It's reports. And it has the reports from the recipients and lobbyists with the contribution information in it, so it can proceed against those people.
Martin, you mentioned that one possible remedy would be that the Indian tribe can waive its immunity. I would ask you, why would they ever do that? Why is that a genuine remedy? They haven't done it here.
They haven't done it here, but it's been done in other contexts. And I should say they haven't done it here because the bargaining table has been abandoned. So they haven't had the opportunity to do it
and
here.
And they abandoned the bargaining table?
No, they didn't. We are willing to talk tomorrow. I will have the tribal representatives there tomorrow
and
to talk about
this. And what would they be bargaining at the bargaining table, and why?
They would be bargaining about the tribal regulation under the PRA, and they would be bargaining about the ability to potentially bring a lawsuit against the tribe as a result of that. That's what government-to-government agreements
but
amount
to. But I don't
see
any incentive on the part of the tribe to give up anything if they have absolute immunity.
Oh, no. The tribe would be incentivized to do that because, Your Honor, they're complying with the PRA now or trying to. They're not trying to violate it. So that isn't going to put burden on them at all. Secondly, as to the reports and information, that is otherwise available. They put it on their website, so making that available is not going to burden them. What that will provide the advantage of is having them retain their sovereign status, not have it be waived in a court of law where there's a declared rule that unhinges that, and it would allow them to participate in California on a level that would be appropriate and consistent with their sovereign interests.
So I want to make sure that I heard you correctly. Your clients are willing to sit down tomorrow to resume negotiations.
No question about it. Now, the other remedies that are available to the state, and there are a whole panoply of them here, include changing the terms of the legislation itself. They can provide for the tribes not being able to donate or people not being able to accept donations from the tribes or lobbyists not being able to accept payments from the tribes and move the issue to tribal members who aren't protected by lawsuit immunity can be regulated, and if there's concern about that, then you can establish a waiver if you give a contribution. You have to be regulated by the PRA and come to the table that way. So there are many meaningful ways to achieve the regulatory interest that's involved in this case.
At this stage, you're saying that the tribe is voluntarily complying with all the regulations?
It's trying, yes.
And short of consenting to a lawsuit, what kind of mechanism does the agency have to compel compliance with those regulations? What teeth does it have?
Well, the teeth that it has would be to strike an agreement with the tribe that would provide for enforcement and regulation. Or it can monitor the tribe's activities and indicate that they should comply. It could sue tribal members.
But if the tribe wished, couldn't they just simply withhold any information?
If the tribe withheld the information and the result was that the FPPC filed a lawsuit to get it, we would be back in the issue that confronts this court.
Well, getting back to that, are we talking about a federal common law or a doctrine that's rooted in the Constitution that's been made constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court? Because the Constitution doesn't expressly say right. that tribes are immune from suit, does it?
No, it doesn't. But very much by constitutional design, it is. When the court used the term common law in discussing the immunity, it was a recognition, as the Alden case points out, that the doctrine of sovereign immunity was a product of English common law. It was perhaps the fundamental attribute of sovereignty.
So are we bound to follow federal common law?
But this is federal common law that became embedded in the Constitution through the structure of the Constitution. And as a result, it is just a fundamental principle. Take the law of search and seizure. That has common law origin, but when it was incorporated in the Constitution, it is a fundamental right. And
what are the words in the federal Constitution that you feel embodies a common law principle of sovereign immunity for Indian tribes?
Well, I would point the court to the Alden case on this. The Alden case indicated that sovereign immunity was such a fundamental principle that it needn't be expressed in the Constitution at the time of the convention.
And wait, it's so fundamental that it doesn't have to be expressed?
It wasn't expressed. The 11th Amendment is the only expression of sovereign immunity, and the 11th Amendment came about because the U.S. Supreme Court had authorized a lawsuit against a sovereign, and Congress immediately responded and said, wait a minute, that is not the constitutional design.
What are the words that you rely on specifically in the 11th Amendment or elsewhere as the basis for sovereign immunity?
The words are not there, sovereign immunity, but in terms of the Indian tribes themselves, they received sovereign status on the enactment of the Constitution, and that included suit immunity. The Blatchford case, U.S. Supreme Court case, makes that clear.
You still in haven't Commerce given Clause, me the words. I'd like to know what words
right.
you're relying on.
The Indian Commerce Clause, the Treaty Clause, and the Supremacy Clause gave the tribes sovereign status embedded in the Constitution, along with the rights that go with that.
So that, sovereign immunity is sort of a gloss that you get from these other provisions?
And it's considered to be a fundamental attribute of sovereignty, and there is no debate here about the tribe's sovereignty. That's the linkage, yes.
And what about the guarantee of a republican form of government to the states? Does that come in conflict with what you view as a constitutional basis for sovereign immunity, and how do we resolve that conflict if there is one?
There is no conflict, Your Honor, if we look at the terms of the guarantee clause and we look at this lawsuit. And if we look at the Supreme Court's guarantee jurisprudence, there's also no conflict. On the first point, the guarantee clause puts an obligation by its express terms on Congress. It doesn't put an obligation on the federal Indian tribes to do anything. So if the proper party defendant here, if there's a breach of the guarantee clause, is the Congress. Looking at the jurisprudence, you will not find a single case decided under the guarantee clause that would elevate the reserve states' rights here against the sovereign immunity and support a lawsuit. There isn't one. We know that because the best the Court of Appeal could come up with was a law review article to provide that affirmative right. Why isn't it there? It's not there because the U.S. Supreme Court's jurisprudence provides that guarantee clause cases are not justiciable. But if we even indulge the assumption that they are, they only implicate affirmative federal action, which you'll see in the New York case or the Gregory case. There's no affirmative federal action here. And they have to invade the form and function of the state government. It is a very high threshold. Here, we are dealing with the timely reporting of campaign contribution information freely available to the states from other sources. It
How would you distinguish the Gregory case, which you just referred to, that validates the state political process in terms of a judge's retirement?
Two things about the Gregory case, I think, flesh out the point. The first is that Gregory involved an affirmative federal statute and action that was invasive and the state was seeking to enjoin. That is not what's going on here. The FPPC is complaining about congressional inaction in not abrogating suit immunity. The second, as to Gregory, the court was looking at the qualifications of elected officers and saying that you are interfering with qualifications. That got to the threshold of the form and function of government.
Isn't that what's happening here, the form and function of California's political process?
If we were talking about federal legislation that said you can't have a PRA, I might agree, Your Honor, but not as to the reporting provisions that are at issue in this case.
But Mr. Martin, I hear some conflict, some tension in your argument. On the one hand, you say that the tribes want to comply with the Political Reform Act. Is that true?
The Agua Caliente tribe does want to comply with the Political Reform
Act. And on the other hand, you're saying that the tribes don't have to report these contributions because the commission can get that information from the recipients.
I'm saying that that's the practical reality of where the commission can get the information. And if the tribe...
Do you agree with me that there's some value in having both the contributor and the recipients report the information to the commission?
I agree with that, Your Honor, but that sort of balancing is not part of a sovereign immunity lawsuit
but
analysis.
But don't you agree that that's an important element in enforcing the Political Reform Act?
It is, but it can't... You don't balance away the right to sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity turns on status, not context. Look at the 11th Amendment cases, the Seminole Tribe case on the one hand and the 11th Circuit case on the other. Indian Gaming Reform Act, comprehensive piece of federal legislation, paramount state interests on both sides of the issue. The tribe undertook to sue the state of Florida and said, you have to enter a compact with us under IGRA, express congressional direction. The Supreme Court said, sorry, a lawsuit is not available to you to enforce that comprehensive federal statute. When Florida turned around and sued the tribe, the 11th Circuit said the same thing. The sovereign has immunity. You have to use another option.
But you stand on your argument that your Agua Caliente tribe is willing to comply with the Political Reform Act.
We are trying to comply right now, and I take that to be willing to comply,
You're prepared to withdraw that motion to quash summons for lack of personal jurisdiction based on the doctrine of tribal sovereign immunity?
Not for 1 minute, Your Honor, because that is what's at stake in this proceeding for the tribe, and we are not prepared to withdraw that motion until we have an agreement in place, government to government, that accomplishes a different result.
Mr. Margaret, if I understand you in the beginning to indicate that the doctrine of sovereign immunity, tribal sovereign immunity, originated in judicial common law, did I understand you to say that?
It has its origins in English common law, yes.
Is not the common law susceptible to evolving and changing? And I hope the answer is going to be yes. And that being the case, can we not look at the changed circumstances that have been mentioned on the bench? And indeed, the United States Supreme Court in the Quorum of Tribe case points out that tribal immunity in our interdependent and mobile society extends beyond what is needed to safeguard tribal self-governance, which would have been a justification. It's evident when tribes take part in nation's commerce, ski resorts, gambling, sales of cigarettes. Right. Are we not entitled to look at the changed circumstances and balance those against the need of the state to preserve the integrity of its electoral process? Accept the invitation of the United States Supreme Court to perhaps reexamine this, thereby force the issue and let it see where it goes.
Let me answer the last part of that question first. The U.S. Supreme Court's invitation was to Congress, not to the courts. There is no hint or suggestion in any U.S. Supreme Court opinion dealing with the suit immunity that the court itself is free to do away
if
with the immunity.
If we were to decide differently from what you wish, presumably it would be petitioned to the United States Supreme Court, and we would then find out to whom the invitation was extended and whether they agree with the response.
But we would know the answer to that question when we go back to your first question. There are certainly principles of common law that are subject to interpretation by courts. And the common law does indeed, in many circumstances, expand and contract. I would not debate that for a minute. That is part of the judicial function. The explanation of common law as it relates to tribal sovereign immunity is entirely different, as the Wold case and the Santa Clara case tell us. While the common law immunity arises from you couldn't sue the king, it was an inherent right of the sovereign, when we got to the Constitutional Convention, what makes it immutable now is that the tribes were recognized and preserved as sovereigns.
But isn't one point of view that Congress has the authority to confer sovereign immunity, but in the absence of some explicit enactment to that effect, there is no sovereign immunity except through the deference to Congress that the U.S. Supreme Court has shown?
There's no authority that's relevant to this particular line of argument that would be impactful there, because only Congress was given plenary power to abrogate the immunity. It doesn't have to empower somebody to have it. Now, getting to the case that you mentioned that has the tribes expanding their horizons into elements of society, we need to keep some separation here between cases that deal with the preemptive effect of federal law and cases that deal with the suit immunity. The suit immunity analysis has always been a sovereign immunity analysis, with the only two questions you ever ask a sovereign. Is there authorization for the suit from a higher sovereign or a statute, or has there been consent?
Mr. Martin, your time is up, assuming you wish to save time for rebuttal.
I do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Kenyon.
Thank you. Good morning. Charity Kenyon on behalf of the Real Party and Interest, the Fair Political Practices Commission.
Ms. Kenyon, instinctively, one would agree with your view that here the state should be able to seek penalties from the Indian tribe for violating over a number of years, I think, was it 1998, 2001, 2002, for violating the Political Reform Act by not reporting various lobbying interests, making late contributions of more than $1 million, and by refusing or by not complying with the requirements of state law of filing certain campaign statements. And again, instinctively, one would want, for lack of a better term, would want to give the state that option. But I think the hurdle, and I think an enormous hurdle, that you would have to overcome is taking a look at what the United States Supreme Court has said. And earlier I mentioned two cases, and the court has said that Indian tribes cannot be sued and only Congress can allow such suits. And as far as I know, there has been no allowance of a suit against Indian tribes. So how would you, from your perspective, have this court agree with your position, given the sovereign immunity hurdle?
Well, from our perspective, it's a matter of common law jurisprudence. This court does have to look at the context of the precedents that announce a very broad protection for Indian immunity from suit. And those in Kiowa, the most recent case that we're talking about today, the court has said, has labeled itself on page 758 or 759 of the decision, this as an economic context. And it looks back to the Potawatomi decision where the court expanded immunity from suit, expanded a common law doctrine, that's the question, so are we expanding it, beyond questions of self-governance in that case to questions of business activities. And the court in that, in Potawatomi said, we're going to defer to Congress because Congress has been well aware of this suit immunity doctrine in the common law and hasn't abrogated it in order to enforce a policy of protecting self-governance and self-sufficiency. So the context, which is still Article I and very much within the context of Congress's powers and not in the context of Article IV. There is no case. The court has already recognized, all the parties have recognized, there is no case that has dealt with this common law doctrine in the context of the Article IV powers of a state to protect its political processes, its separate sovereign identity.
Now, you speak in terms of deference by the U.S. Supreme Court to Congress in Kiowa, and do you feel that that concept of deference hinges in large part upon the nature of a particular state interest that may be involved in a given case? In other words, you have the spectrum from a purely private personal right where weighing that against the interests of the Indian tribe, deference may be viewed as more appropriate than when we have a situation which I believe is unprecedented in the nation's jurisprudence of something as substantial as the core of the political and electoral process. And I guess your suggestion is that deference may not be appropriate or as appropriate when the interest is this substantial.
Yeah, it isn't warranted when we get beyond the Article I powers of Congress and we're talking about the balance of power between state and federal government that the Constitution protects and the liberties that are protected by that balance. And the court, a lot of people have searched on both sides of this case and the judiciary, and no, there is no precedent. This would be the first state or federal court that would extend this common law doctrine to an arena and determine that a state does not have the power to protect its political processes from corruption by tribal contributors.
I'm getting back to a point I made earlier. Just taking a look at the express observations made by the United States Supreme Court, that doesn't help your position. And initially I used the word instinctively. And of course, deciding by instinct is not something that we are supposed to do. That's simply not good enough. Yes, instinctively one may have reaction, but in the final analysis, we, this court, is bound by United States precedent. And taking a look at Santa Clara Pueblo, where in 1978 the High Court said, without congressional authorization, the Indian nations are exempt from suit. And quoting again, as I did earlier when Mr. Martin was at a podium, suits against Indian tribes are barred by sovereign immunity absent a clear waiver by the tribe or congressional abrogation. And neither of the two things I just mentioned is present in this case, at least from my personal perspective, looking at United States precedent. Unless you are arguing to this court, this court is not at all bound by any precedent by the High Court. I don't see how, at least at this point in oral argument, I don't see how we can go your way. If we were to agree with you, I would assume that the odds are quite a bit over 50% that this case will be granted certiorari in the United States. And it's the kind of issue that only the High Court can resolve. And again, I know that you have relied on, what was it, on the 10th Amendment in arguing your position?
Is we're arguing about the structure, yes, Article 4 versus Articles 1, 2, and 3, the structure of the Constitution that guarantees not only indestructible union but indestructible and separate sovereign states. And they are not, the notion, this Court has itself quoted this phrasing from Justice Douglas, the notion that the sovereign position of the states must find its protection in the will of a transient majority of Congress is foreign to and a negation of our constitutional system. And when the United States Supreme Court looked in the McConnell case at congressional power to limit the corrupting influence of campaign contributions on state elections, it said that long ago had determined that Congress, to say that Congress is without power to pass appropriate legislation to safeguard an election from the improper use of money to influence the result, is to deny to the nation in a vital particular the power of self-protection. And the Court has said that the states have that same power of self-protection. It is a constitutional power that has not been at issue or anywhere in the mind of the Court. And the Court, as Justice Scalia said in Nevada versus Hicks, you have to look at these precedents and determine what the Court had in mind.
If I may stop you for just a moment, I just need some clarification on an issue which I consider difficult. Yes, it's clear to me that you have relied on the 10th Amendment and the Guarantee Clause. And then, looking at the Guarantee Clause, as I see it, that simply protects the rights of the states to a republican form of government. And I don't see how that clause protects the FPPC. A holding that your client, the FPPC, may not sue the tribe will not, in my view, destroy California's republican form of government.
Well, we think, and the United States Supreme Court has agreed with us, and this Court has also, that these protections against corruption or the appearance of corruption, and we're not just talking about late reporting, we're talking about enforcing the Political Reform Act. So we're talking about money laundering. We're talking limits on lobbyist gifts. We're talking about the premier statute in the country for protecting political processes from corruption.
Your point basically is, I guess, that a guarantee of state sovereignty is illusory without the power to protect against the corruption of the very government structure.
Yes, I'm saying it's not just my point. I'm saying it's the point the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that this Court has recognized, and that the doctrine of, it is a context that the doctrine of immunity from suit has never been considered by the United States Supreme Court. So obviously the United States Supreme Court precedents are binding, but those absolutes are not self-defining or self-enforcing. And our power to protect our government is not dependent on congressional action.
If we were to disagree with you, and this is a point that I explored earlier with Mr. Martin, and he agreed with an observation I made. Presumably, his view would be that, well, your client could simply take a look at the filings of the recipient of the money. Would that be a sufficient remedy from your part?
Well,
assuming that the recipient will indeed follow the law?
Exactly. There are really two answers to that. One answer is in the policy making that went behind the construction of the Political Reform Act. Absolutely, it would not be sufficient.
And apart from that, I think the other avenue proposed to us would be, well, you and the tribe should really start to negotiate. And yes, the Indian tribes might be willing to agree to be sued.
Right. Well, we haven't reached any such agreement, but we don't need to. This court shouldn't be getting to the question of alternatives really until it first determines that the state doesn't have the power to enforce the law that was written, the policy making that was done by the electorate, and that ordinarily would be respected by the whole political question doctrine. You don't get to alternatives until you've determined that this common law precedent extends to this fact situation.
Ms. Kenyon, would your position be the same if these particular contributions were made by the country of Mexico or the country of Canada?
No, there's a specific provision of both the Political Reform Act and the federal election campaign laws that prohibits foreign state sovereigns to contribute at all. And Indian tribes under the PRA are a person as they are under the federal election law. They're treated the same under federal election law as under the PRA. They're both a person subject to regulation. So the question here is, are we unable to enforce that policy that has been developed? And as I said, is the premier one in the state. It's been held up recently before Congress as the ideal. It would be ironic indeed if the state had the power to write that law of self-protection, but not to enforce it.
Before you get too far away from Justice Kennard's first question, would you please answer why the remedy of getting the information from the recipients is not enough?
Well, first of all, the remedy from the recipient applies, if it applies, only if both sides are complying, and if you know that one side doesn't have to comply, why would the recipient comply? And it doesn't work with money laundering. It doesn't work with lobbyist gifts. It doesn't work with independent expenditures where the recipient doesn't.
And why not?
Because there's no report at all by the recipient. So in many situations, that doesn't work. But our contention, it doesn't work at all if you know the other side doesn't have to play. That's the policy decision that went into the structure of the political reform.
So basically, say trust but verify?
Yes, that's the way it works. If both sides know that you're watching, then is there...
What about Mr. Martin's suggestion that an alternative solution would be simply to say that the tribes can't contribute? Okay, if Mexico and Canada can't contribute, the tribes can't contribute.
Well, again, we're rewriting the Political Reform Act, but I think at this point we get to where Justice Thomas is saying, we're having trouble here because we have to hold these precedents on Indian sovereignty require us to hold in our minds the concept that they're sovereigns and they're not sovereigns at the same time and make it work. These are domestic dependent nations, all of whose members are citizens. So there's nothing under the federal campaign law or the state law that would preclude them. They have the right to participate.
And wouldn't there be significant First Amendment and other problems?
This is a group that's composed entirely of citizens of the state of California. I'd like to remind all of us that the interests of this tribe, they've already pointed out, may be different from their own tribe members who are entitled to the protections of these laws. But to the other less wealthy and less powerful tribes, and to members of other tribes, all of those individuals are citizens of the state of California that are entitled to the protection of these very laws that we're seeking enforced here. So it's not just...
But Mr. Martin says, and I'm assuming that he's making it in good faith, that his client wants to comply with the Political Reform Act. So why isn't a government-to-government negotiation the best way to settle this dispute, considering the weight of authority in favor of sovereign immunity?
Well, again, best. And my point is that we still have to find there's no jurisdiction to enforce the statute as written. But why isn't the best? I mean, the best was a policy decision made. We obviously then would have to hope that we could find every single tribe in the state would be willing to enter into that kind of a negotiation. We've already seen the collapse of that kind of negotiation, not only in this case, but in the legislature. I mean, it would be to say also that the protections of the commission from the influence of special interests that were written into the structure of the Political Reform Act would be out the window. I mean, the people of the state of California protected the designed a statute where the legislature has no appointments to the commission. The general fund appropriation is guaranteed. It's an independent commission. That falls away when we have to negotiate with Indian tribes and every single Indian tribe in the state and hope that we can come to an agreement. But we don't get there, and we don't know the content of what that agreement would look like until this court says we don't have jurisdiction to enforce the statute adopted by the voters of the state of California, protect their political processes from corruption.
Well, suppose, and solely for purposes of oral argument, that we were to disagree with your view. I posed the question earlier, and it was a two-part question. I got an answer to the first, but not quite to the second part of the question. And no, I'm not blaming you. It's very hard in the give and take of oral argument to remember everything that's being said. But to get to the point, I thought that you said we really don't get to the question of remedy unless this court has disagreed with you. Well, but we have to resolve the issue here, and we are exploring the various avenues. Now, let's suppose we disagree with you. I asked you whether it would be a viable alternative to propose what Mr. Martin has proposed in his argument to the court. He said it's no big deal for you, your client, to sit at a bargaining table with the Indian tribe and give and take, and yes, there is. There might be no problem, given what is at stake, that the Indian tribe would indeed agree to be sued. And I would like to hear from you, is that truly a viable alternative, that the Indian tribe would agree to be sued?
No, it's not a viable alternative. It hasn't happened yet. It won't happen. And certainly not if the tribe knows that we have no power to enforce the Political Reform Act. So the answer to that question, if I didn't make it clear before, is no, it's not a viable alternative.
Getting back to the threshold issue, apart from any other alternative remedies, has the U.S. Supreme Court repudiated any portion of the Santa Clara Pueblo case in which it stated that sovereign immunity cannot be implied but must be unequivocally expressed? And where is it unequivocally expressed that immunity has been waived here?
There is... No, it hasn't said that. But again,
it hasn't repudiated that statement.
No, but it's again, these are not absolutes, as the court said. They're self-defining or self-policing. And the court has said that it will police the boundaries of congressional power, Article I power, and it's said that particularly in with respect to campaign finance and the integrity of political process. It's also said that recently with respect to Indian sovereignty. The most recent cases of the United States Supreme Court, Duro versus Reyna, United States versus Lara, Nevada versus Hicks, each one of them, the court has talked in terms of sovereignty of great concern about impacts on state sovereignty. It's disclaimed impacts on state sovereignty. It's talked about concern about non-member citizens' impacts on them. It's talked about consent of the governed. So it's even in the area of sovereignty that has been traditionally within Congress's Article I powers. It's talked about policing those limits, and it's talked about it's talked about concern for impacts on state sovereignty. So you don't have to just look at campaign finance.
Any impacts on state sovereignty, or are these cases that relate to tribal sovereignty?
Those are actually tribal court jurisdiction cases. Mm-hmm. But the court has said we're looking at the outside limits of tribal sovereignty, and we think that the doctrine of tribal sovereign immunity, as broadly as it has been expressed in Kiowa, the court said, page 759, that it is subject to constitutional limitations. And that those precedents don't stretch to this point. Those constitutional limits are at issue in this case, and they're in the structure of the federal government that balances powers between states and the federal government and guarantees constitutional powers to the states to protect the integrity of their political processes.
What is the significance here
of the Indian Commerce Clause. At first glance, one could make an argument that no, the Indian Commerce Clause would not support your position. It would appear that rules pertaining to whether Indian tribes may be sued may have a significant impact on commerce. It could be argued that if, as has been alleged, there were these violations by this Indian tribe, one could argue it was no doubt motivated by a desire to elect politicians who would support Indian commercial ventures and to encourage the voters to enact initiatives that would further such ventures. What is your response to that?
Well, our response is that clearly hasn't been the context of any of these decisions. But by the way, these tribes have those concerns on their part, but all their members are citizens who may have different interests. The other tribes, less wealthy tribes, have different interests. We're all interested in being informed voters. We're all interested in protecting our political processes from corruption. We're all interested in avoiding money laundering and the kind of scandal that has disrupted Congress. So the Commerce Clause, to the extent it protects one set of citizens, would undermine the rights of the rest of the citizens, including other members of other tribes. So that is not the context of any of these United States Supreme Court precedents. And the court has repeatedly said that those constitutional rights of the state are not dependent on congressional action, and that the court would police the extent of congressional power in that area, not to infringe on the right of the state to protect its political processes from corruption, with the potentially disastrous, that's the court's words, disastrous potential to undermine public confidence in our Republican form of government. And that would be the consequence of extending this doctrine. It is a common law doctrine. The clear question before the court is whether it has ever been extended to this context. The Supreme Court itself has labeled the context that it's considered the doctrine in as a shield for Indian self-governance, as a shield for Indian economic sufficiency, but never as a sword, never as something to allow tribes or a tribe to undermine the integrity of the state political processes.
So with the right to participate comes the obligation to be accountable.
The obligation to be accountable and the protection of the laws that go. I mean, it's not just the obligation to be accountable, but the right to be protected by the laws that require that accountability and protect that system from corruption. If there's no further questions, we'll submit it. Thank you.
Apparently none. Thank you, Ms. Kenyon. Mr. Markman, you may argue in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with the Lara case, which was cited, because the Lara case is important to the two constants that I indicated are at the core of the tribe's sovereign immunity. And you'll see them repeated definitively in that case. Lara says that the tribes are sovereigns. That's the whole debate in the case. It has to do with their sovereign status. And second, that sovereign status is under the control of Congress. Those are the two of the three linchpins of my immunity.
There are absolutely no limits that can be placed upon the tribal sovereign immunity.
The only limits on tribal sovereign immunity where a lawsuit is concerned are exactly the same as to a state or the federal government. Authorization to sue the tribe or consent to suit. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said there is no difference in the treatment of the federal government, the states, or the tribes for this purpose. And that's why this case is not unprecedented in the sense of the consistent answer that comes from sovereign immunity.
But you would agree with us that this is the first time that the political process itself is under attack.
I do agree with that, but in sovereign immunity cases, the context doesn't determine, balancing doesn't determine, sovereign status determines. And after that, the judicial power ceases. And the idea that this is a common law doctrine that can be construed away, I point the court again to the Alden decision of the U.S. Supreme Court and the Blatchford decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which put sovereign immunity, as far as the tribes are concerned, firmly embedded in our constitutional structure.
Well, let me ask you this. It seems that if one took your argument to its logical extreme, tribes would be immunized from criminal prosecution or any kind of conduct, no matter how severe, no matter how much public safety or the interests of the state.
Those debates and issues actually have taken place relative to the tribe's sovereign status and the preemptive effect of that status as it relates to the intersection with state laws, even criminal laws. But that's a different analysis. That's the preemption analysis where these interests are balanced and tribal sovereignty gives way. The suit immunity cases, as Kiowa illustrates, are always treated differently. Kiowa expressly rejected that preemption analysis as applied to the suit immunity and went back to the only two boundaries that have ever existed, congressional authorization and consent. The last point I'd like to make is that the argument this morning has produced the answer to this. When you have sovereign immunity, the message is find another way. If this statute is so ideal, Congress can take care of it. The sovereign bar is available here. The First Amendment concerns are not apparent because the
What kind of a remedy is that for the state to rely upon the goodwill of Congress? Congress is not always attentive to states' rights.
In the structure of our Constitution, that is the remedy for a sovereign that wants to gain the right to sue. It is the recognized remedy that the U.S. Supreme Court has established.
It's an empty remedy in this situation, isn't it?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because there is evidence in the record of many times that Congress has responded. In the Kiowa case, where the court queried, shouldn't Congress respond, it did respond. And it enacted an entire economic statute in direct response to Kiowa that provided that the suit immunity was no longer intact. So it is viable, and we can't look askance at it. But
assertion that there is no, that if we were simply to say, well, the tribes can't contribute, we're going to treat them just like Canada and Mexico. When the tribes are composed, as we all acknowledge and appropriately so, of American citizens.
Right.
How can we say that an organized group of American citizens can't participate in the democratic process?
Well, I think there are several mixed questions there, but let me see if I can come at it this way. The tribe, which is what we're talking about, is not a citizen. The individual members of the
no group of people
right.
can be a citizen. However, there is a huge body of jurisprudence that says citizens of the United States have the right to join together in groups and
right.
participate in that way in the political process. So perhaps we could fast forward to something that really is germane.
Well, no. My point was that I think that gives more discretion to the state to deal with the tribe as it relates to the PRA, the same way Congress has established and the state has established that foreign governments can't participate because of the second thing I was going to get to, and that is that the individual members still are capable of participating and they're subject to regulation. Even if there's the First Amendment hurdle creeps in there, we can...
subject to regulation if there isn't any reporting that's required.
No, but the tribal members are not within the scope of the immunity that we're asking for here today, Your Honor. So if tribal members are making contributions on their own behalf outside of the context of the tribe...
But if they choose to do it through the tribe, then they're home free.
Yes, but then we can go to other options also that have been discussed here, which are going to the recipients. If the problem is that lobbyists aren't reporting and being audited effectively enough, we can change those regulations.
But when you say that...
here the remedy, or one remedy, would be that the state can simply go after the recipient. But that's assuming that the recipient would follow the law and say, yes, I just received $1 million from the Indian tribe. But what if the recipient breaks the law? What remedy would the state have?
Mr. Martin, although your time is up, you may respond to Justice.
The recipient would be subject to a lawsuit in that situation, and the state would have a perfect remedy to solve that problem.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you, Ms. Kenyon. The matter stands submitted.